Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio ranks about middling when it comes to graduation rates for its state colleges and universities. Governor John Kasich thinks the Buckeye State should be doing better, however, and his budget, as proposed, would reward those institutions with higher rates of graduation. Joining us now to talk about graduation rates nationally is Scott Smallwood. He's managing editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Thanks for having me in.
To our listeners, we ask you this question, whether or not you think keeping track of graduation rates is helpful to you as you look at what, where and if to go to college. And if you dropped out of college, do you think that's something that should be noted? Should people know what the dropout rate is? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So, Scott Smallwood, the governor of Ohio, wants to make high graduation rates a trigger for more state funding. Are other states putting that kind of emphasis on graduation rates that you know of?
There's certainly a lot more emphasis on graduation rates nationally, not quite in the same way that Kasich has proposed in Ohio. But it's a topic and a statistic that gets a lot more attention now than it used to. It's actually a statistic that the federal government has only been keeping for about 20 years, and it has a ton of problems. Really, it sounds like kind of a simple thing, like how many people start college, how many people finish college. It turns out in practice that's a much harder number to come up with the way they count it.
Yeah, because a lot of times we identify with that with an institution, but I transferred a couple times and
right.
Didn't graduate within 4 years, kill me. But and that's not unusual.
Not unusual at all. About a third of college students right now transfer at least once, and your experience would mean that wherever you started, that institution would have been recorded in the federal definition as not graduating you, and the institution you transferred to wouldn't have gotten credit for that in its graduation rate either. So in a lot of ways, it's a flawed measure. It's the only one that we really have that's as comprehensive as this, but the joke we have around our newsroom is, look at our last presidential campaign, and neither President Obama or Mitt Romney would have been counted. Obama
right.
Obama started at Occidental College and then transferred to Columbia, and Romney started at Stanford and then took a two-year Mormon mission and then transferred to BYU, and all of that means neither of those guys would have been counted as graduates.
So what do graduation rates tell us about an institution that's edifying, at least from your perspective?
I think certainly it's edifying when you're talking about similar institutions. So in a lot of ways, we think of this statistic, or it kind of sounds like a statistic that's a measure of an outcome. Sounds like something on the backside rather than an input measure. But really, when people look at it, it looks a lot more like, what are the types of students that you accept? And so in Ohio, it's not going to be a surprise that Ohio State would have a higher graduation rate than Youngstown State, once you look at the types of students and their education background that start at those institutions. And so really, probably its most powerful measure is when you're looking at similar institutions that are dealing with a similar population that have similar students who had similar SAT scores and have come from similar socioeconomic backgrounds. Once you look at that, then seeing differences in graduation rates might be a lot more meaningful than just comparing the difference between Oberlin's graduation rate and Kent State's graduation rate.
My guest is Scott Smallwood. He's managing editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about graduation rates at Ohio State colleges and universities. Question or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Have they told us different things over time? So you said that it's been since the 90s. It's been about 20 years now that they've been collecting
right.
these statistics. Has the collection process been uniform over that time?
It's been uniform over that time, but what's changed is the underlying student. And so what it measures is first-time, full-time students That has really changed. So as we have now kind of what we think of as a non-traditional student actually becomes the majority, people that are older, people who have started and then gone back, people who started a two-year college and then transferred to a four-year college, all of those ways of being a college student aren't really reflected in this number. And so the measure hasn't changed, but the underlying population of college students has really shifted in the last two decades.
And do we know, given the confines of that definition that is used for the calculation, do we know whether graduation rates are going up or down in general?
In general, when you look at it, they seem pretty stagnant,
stable.
Pretty steady.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're not changing dramatically. In some ways, access, given that more people are going to college, that steady rate might be seen as a good thing. And then the other thing I'd say is that just to keep in mind that there's a big difference between graduation rates, which we're talking about, and attainment rates that we sometimes talk about. So graduation rates are just how many of the people who enrolled in college finished, and then attainment, which we're often talking about in a lot of the president's goals are around attainment, are how many people in the population have a college degree. And so those sometimes get conflated, but they're really quite different ideas.
Is there any correlation, at least that we know of, between graduation rates and attainment? So if you have a state with high rates of graduation, do you also tend to have a state with high rates of attainment?
I would think so. I don't have that
okay.
Right off. I mean, just from a kind of statistical thinking about the population, yes. I mean, you need those people to start college if they're going to finish, but they are just two different things, and you might have different public policies. If your goal is an attainment goal, you might have a different set of policies than if your goal is increasing the graduation rate. One of the criticisms of too much focus on completion and on graduation rates is one great way to up your graduation rate if you're a college is to make sure you're admitting fewer unprepared students. And then people can question whether that's really what we want that college to be doing.
Ergo the Youngstown State OSU comparison.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, OSU has done a great deal to tighten up its requirements. But the president of Ohio State, Gordon Gee, has done a couple other things, too. He started, initiated the first-year experience. It's a year-long program for freshmen, specifically created to cement their relationship with OSU all the way to graduation. Is that unusual?
No, I think we're seeing a lot more of those, a lot more of thoughts around the importance of retention and success, sometimes I call them success courses or success coaching, other attempts to really intensively connect with students and make sure they're finding their way through college. There's also a lot of efforts around crunching, kind of part of our big data move in the country, a lot of attention on finding the numbers behind getting the indicators to those college administrators about who's on the track to graduate, who's not on the track to graduate, and if they're not, what can we do to rectify that?
Kind of like biomarkers.
Exactly.
What can we look forward to?
Right.
Rod in Columbus, you're on the air with Scott Smallwood of the Chronicle of Higher Education. Hi, Rod.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I've noticed, the price of college has increased greatly in the last couple of decades. And also, there's a lot of unemployed college graduates nowadays. I was wondering how many students drop out because either they can't afford the price of college anymore or they've decided that the investment isn't worth it.
Well, two really different questions, but what do we know about any kind of connection between the cost of college and dropout rates, Scott?
I don't have anything on that off the top of my head. It's certainly, there's a lot. You can look at the places that have high dropout rates or low graduation rates, and their student populations have a lot of pressures on them, both economic, family pressures, lots of other reasons that it might be harder to get through college. And you know, you've got a place like a Youngstown State. They have you know, maybe a third of the students graduating in 4 years. There's a lots of reasons, including economic, that would get in the way of that.
Okay, thank you, Rad. What about perceptions that, and we're going to be talking about this later on in the program too, but perceptions that college isn't worth it, that they're just not getting out of it what they think they should?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly an issue that we're hearing a lot of in the country. I know you'll have guests on later to talk mm-hmm. more in detail about that. The statistics in general, the people who graduate college, there is a big wage premium over their lifetime for getting that degree. That said, the people who go to college and then don't graduate, they don't look very different statistically than people who never enrolled.
How big a deal are graduation rates in the higher ed community? Do schools brag about them when they're high and ignore them when they're low?
I don't know about ignore them. They certainly want
to. I mean, ignore them in terms of publicizing it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's they're getting more attention than they've ever gotten. So in that way, it's definitely a thing people in the higher ed community are paying attention to. That said, as I mentioned before, it really matters dramatically what type of institution you are. And so if you're in general, those institutions don't want to be compared to other types of institutions that may not be a fair comparison. And so they're not going to brag about that graduation rate. But there are certainly places, if it's really high, then that's something that you're going to mention. But for the most part, the places that have very high graduation rates, they are bragging about a lot of other things as well. That's not the type of thing they need to talk too much about.
You and I talked earlier, they've only been collecting the statistics for about 20 years, and the way they're doing it, it disregards a lot of new kinds of students,
right.
Non-traditional students that are becoming more and more a larger percentage.
Yeah.
Is there any thought, is anybody giving any thought to changing the way they calculate it?
There is, actually. And the federal government, the Education Department, announced last year that they are going to change the definition to get at transfer students more clearly. But that's going to take a while to work out. And really, it's a lot more complicated than it sounds.
No, it sounds very complicated to me.
And it's really complicated, actually, in large part because higher education has pushed against, and privacy advocates have pushed against, a system that would make this a lot easier. And that's what is known within higher ed as a unit record system. So what we do, what the system does to count graduation rates right now and to count all sorts of things, is it looks at institutions and it gathers data at the institution level. But as students transfer around, start and stop and go to different types of institutions, there's another way we could be counting them, and that is we could be counting them as individual students, have a ID number. The IRS knows about you and has a number that associates with you, and it's not looking all the time at your employer. It knows stuff about you as an individual. And there's no reason that the government couldn't be tracking that. And then we'd have a very good data about you, for instance, and your experience starting at one institution and transferring somewhere else. The data would be able to capture that. There was a push for that a couple years ago. There are still lots of people who think that's the obvious solution to this problem, but there are other people who are very opposed to the privacy implications of tracking students in that way.
My guest once again, Scott Smallwood. He's managing editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. We're going to continue our conversation about graduation rates, why they matter or not. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thanks for joining us today. It's 61 degrees in downtown Columbus. Expect some sunshine and we'll warm up to a high near 71 today. Cloudy for tonight and a low of 58. And you're running out of time to support our station and register to win an iPad mini. Our spring membership drive begins soon, and by making your pledge right now, you'll be automatically entered to win an iPad mini. No pledge is necessary and entries are only accepted at WOSU.org. But hurry, get your entry in before the start of the drive. And support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio ranks about middling when it comes to graduation rates for its state colleges and universities. Governor John Kasich thinks the Buckeye State should be doing better, and his budget as proposed would reward those institutions with higher rates of graduation. And Ohio State University President Gordon Gee has initiated the First Year Experience, a year-long program for freshmen specifically created to cement the relationship with OSU all the way to graduation. And beginning in 2014, many OSU sophomores will be required to live on campus for the same reason. Still with us is Scott Smallwood, managing editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. Once again, Scott, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us now is Ohio University economics professor, Dr. Richard Vetter. He's director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. Welcome to the show, Dr. Vetter.
Glad to be with you, Ann.
So you're not convinced that higher graduation rates lead to overall or individual economic returns of any particular significance, so a push for higher graduation rates is wasted?
Well, the graduation rate is not a meaningless statistic. And it's true that schools with higher graduation rates have generally had better levels of academic performance and with their students than the ones with low rates. And I've been very critical of schools with low graduation rates, partly for that reason. Having said that, however, the graduation rate is just one statistic, and it's one that is subject to a considerable amount of abuse. Graduating from College A may be quite a different phenomenon or experience than graduating from College B, for example. And one thing, for example, the governor's proposal does is it incentivizes colleges to, of course, get people to graduate, which could be a good thing if what it means is that they help students in trouble study more, or they put more emphasis on academic activities rather than non-academic activities, things like that. But it also could lead to abuses where colleges encourage professors to give high grades, where the grade inflation phenomena, which has been a very real, I think, problem in higher education over the last generation, actually accelerates because colleges are gaming the system to get more money.
What about the first-year experience at OSU and other similar programs created to keep students in school? Is that money well spent, in your opinion?
Well, the idea of getting there is a retention problem, and schools like OSU, which are large, massive organizations, and where students don't feel a sense of connectivity with faculty as much as they do at smaller liberal arts colleges, it's possible that these programs have some potential of achieving some good. It's a cost-benefit case situation, and I don't know whether what President Gee is proposing is good or bad because I haven't really examined it. But just because you say, well, we got to do something about retention, doesn't mean that what you're going to do is successful. If all you do is create a new bureaucracy in the university where people sit around and ponder the problem, it's not likely to have much success.
Just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about graduation rates. Are they important? Do they matter? With Dr. Richard Vetter, director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity and economics professor at Ohio University, and also Scott Smallwood of the Chronicle of Higher Education, where he is the managing editor. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Lots of smart kids can't afford college, and they can't get jobs that will help them work their way through college anymore. And a lot of them either start and drop out, and they're not counted, as Scott Smallwood and I were talking about earlier. What about the way that graduation rates are counted in this country, Dr. Vedder?
Well, I caught a little bit of Scott's comments, and I served on something called the Spellings Commission on the Future of Higher Education 5 or 6 years ago, and we advocated a unit record system, which is the lingo, as Scott mentioned, that we use to describe following a student through from his or her academic progress, actually from kindergarten on all the way through to PhD level, if that be the case. And it is a more efficient way of doing things. It gives us a lot of interesting data and insight into what's going on in a mobile society where people are moving between institutions and majors and so forth. It gives us a lot of data that would allow us, I think, to understand what succeeds and what fails in higher ed. And I have been disappointed that it hasn't moved forward. And the privacy arguments against it, I think, are largely bogus. I mean, I think it's worthwhile to be concerned about privacy, but there are ways of dealing with privacy with ID numbers and so forth, as Scott mentioned. And I think there are some people in the higher ed system who are against transparency generally, who are afraid that if too much information gets out, it might reflect poorly on them as institutions. And so many in the higher education establishment have fought this as well. And I think that is indeed unfortunate.
Scott Smallwood, another tactic that I mentioned earlier that is going to be starting in 2014 at OSU is requiring sophomores to live on campus, the idea being that it further entrenches them into the campus life and gives them more of that connection to the university. Is that, now this is of course a Big Ten university, they've been doing it for, well, I can say at least for 35 years, I know, at Michigan State, but is that common at the bigger universities, or where are we at on that kind of requirement?
I don't know that it's common at the bigger universities. It's certainly a as people think more about retention, as Dr. Vedder mentioned, that's certainly one way that they're going to tackle it. I just pulled up some of the stats from OSU, though, and I'm noting that their graduation rates are on a steady march up in recent years. That said, my other guess is it's also about the increasing selectivity or different students that they might be taking a decade later. But their numbers are up 20 points over the last 10 years.
If I may jump in and segue into Scott's remarks, Scott's absolutely right. And I do think, having looked at the data some myself, that with respect to Ohio State, it is clearly a selectivity improvement that is at work here. And during this period, there has been no changes in the rules major changes with regards to residential living experience. And yet we've had this huge upsurge in any measure you want to use, graduation rates, for example, retention rates, and so forth. So you were asking Scott, and I jumped in. I'm sort of skeptical that the notion of that sophomores living in a university dormitory as opposed to some other sort of living facility would greatly improve retention. I don't know of any study that it's an interesting issue, and I don't know if any study has ever been done that is sort of definitive that people agree is the last word on that issue, because some schools have 1 year requirements, some have two, some have zero, some are mainly commuter schools, and so forth. And I just assumed it was an effort by President Gee to expand the housing, his housing empire at Ohio State, There's being a little cynical, I guess, on my part, because I understand there's going to be a very large housing complex built to accommodate this. But I'd like to see the evidence.
Yeah, it should be said. I'm raising this enough to say that we did request President Gee or someone in his stead join us for this conversation, and we did not get any responses to our request. So unfortunately. So Scott Smallwood, you said it's not clear whether that's something that's happening across the country or spreading.
Not that I'm aware of. And just to reiterate, I think the university in Ohio State's case has been able to have a huge uptick in its graduation rate without doing stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, doesn't that suggest if that graduation rate is that malleable over most likely through changes in the selectivity of the university, what is that graduation rate really, really telling you?
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Professor Vetter, what about the economy? Do you have any thoughts about the downturn in the economy? What it apparently didn't have any effect on OSU, but again, when you're talking about such strict selectivity, that may not matter.
You mean, are you asking with respect to graduation rates or with regards to enrollments or just in general what the economy does to you?
I think graduation rates or at least perhaps enrollments is a better way to look at it. How many people dropped out of college because they couldn't risk the debt?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. There is some evidence. If the evidence points in one direction, it probably is in the direction that it may seem a little counterintuitive to you, that actually in periods of downturn, college enrollments tend to have some increase because students are finding it difficult to get good jobs. So what is the alternative to work? Well, one alternative to work is to invest in your future by going to school. And the cost of going to school in terms of income given up from not working is actually fallen. It's kind of a funny way of putting it, but it's the way us economists tend to look at it. And we call it the opportunity costs of going to college have fallen. So in periods of distress or national economic distress, enrollments sometimes actually rise. And, of course, this varies with the type of institution. They don't rise at Harvard because it's a selective institution that takes the same number of students no matter what the state of the economy. But it does rise at some universities. Including most state universities. And so I think that's good. And the student loan program facilitates this. And you do see a huge surge in federal student financial assistance during downturns because that's a way that these unemployed, newly matriculated college students can finance their education.
Rachel in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just had a quick question regarding some of the retention statistics that are available. Comparing the liberal arts colleges versus the state schools, so I don't know how widespread it is, but the small liberal arts college that I went to had a different credit structure per their semesters. So instead of being on a 16-week semester, we were on a 12-3. So one of the things that made it very complicated, if somebody, say, as a sophomore or a junior, wanted to transfer to a state school to get, say, a less expensive education to complete their degree, it made it very difficult because if they were to transfer, it wasn't an even transfer of credits, and they would essentially lose, instead of transferring in as a full-fledged, junior, they would get a year and a half worth of credit, essentially. And I think that's one of the things that forced a lot of people, at least at the institution I attended, to really stick it out for that full 4 years. And I was just wondering, as far as retention is concerned, if that's something statistically that's been investigated.
Richard Vetter?
Well, I know of no studies specifically on exactly what the caller is talking about, but she is raising an important point. the cost to the student of transferring from one institution to another is often fairly high because of differences in the way colleges operate with respect to crediting. Yes, there's quarter systems versus semester systems, different length periods. Some schools have month periods in the middle of the year for a special kind of short-term study and whatnot, study abroad programs and so forth. And so for people in a world where people are mobile and moving a lot and changing their ideas about things and wanting to change schools because of economic reasons, the barriers to that movement are not inconsequential. And a lot of the reform movements in higher ed have been trying to make that more seamless. The most obvious, of course, is between community colleges and four-year schools. And because often universities will say, well, we won't accept this community college credit, and University A may not accept, University B might. And so this causes a good bit of difficulty. The schools feel that they should have the right to control the curriculum, and before they give a degree, they ought to know what the students have taken. So they have a point of view. But also there is the issue of, shouldn't we lower the barriers to people moving from one university to the other? Just that we have this debate with immigration at the national level about people moving from one country to the other. We have sort of a similar problem, I guess you might say, in universities about students moving from one institution to another.
Scott Smallwood, and any efforts on the part of universities to make things easier for transferring students?
Certainly at some institutions, and as Dr. Vedder mentioned, it's especially important, and certain states are really moving to make their systems more coherent between their community college system and their public four-year systems. Absolutely. That's a major trend, especially in, not everywhere, but in certain states, we're moving toward a more single system where they expect that to happen, and the curriculum and the credit is lined up kind of ahead of time, and they can tell students that this is going to transfer into this, get this credit at this four-year institution. But that is a major problem, and it actually, as what Dr. Vedder was saying, gets into kind of really large questions around what is credit and what are we, what is the credential, and you know, historically, an individual institution wants a lot of control over what they're going to award that degree for, mm-hmm. and that creates a lot of these the challenges, really, an individual kind of fiefdom that we are going to rule and we are going to say this is what credit is and this is what credit is not, and there are a lot of that gets into a very different conversation, but one around credentialing and changes in distance learning and all sorts of things that are going on in higher education.
Dr. Richard Vedder, we have to say goodbye to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
It was delightful. Thanks, Anne.
Dr. Richard Vedder, he's director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. He's also a professor of economics at Ohio University. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about graduation rates, their value, and what they can teach us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, from spying to killing, reporter Mark Mazzetti on the CIA's transformation in the era of long wars and drones. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon from 1 until 2 here on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. Thanks for joining us today for All Sides. And it's 61 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies for today and a high near 71. Mostly cloudy for tonight, a low of 58 degrees. Clouds with a chance of a shower or thunderstorm for Tuesday and a high near 69. Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. And support for 89.7 comes from Green Bean Delivery, offering home delivery of fresh organic produce and natural groceries, striving to make healthy eating more accessible to the communities of Greater Columbus. Details on Green Bean Delivery's products, as well as how to place an order, can be found online at greenbeandelivery.com. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Little more than half of American students who enter college leave with a bachelor's degree. Nationally, Ohio ranks about in the middle. Governor Kasich wants to incentivize graduation rates with budgetary rewards. But even before his proposal, OSU had established a special program and made other changes to improve the rate of graduation at Ohio State. This hour, we're talking about graduation rates and why they matter more than ever. Still with us is Scott Smallwood, managing editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. And once again, thanks for staying with us, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now is Stephen Rose. He's a professor and senior economist at the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I've mentioned that the governor wants to incentivize colleges and universities in Ohio that improve their rates of graduation. Has this been tried anywhere else and with any success that we know of?
Well, you know, the old famous saying, what's measured is treasured. First of all, this 50% number should be put in a little bit more context. Usually the 50% only applies to those who get a four-year degree. And that's somewhat unfair because a lot of people who go to the community colleges, certainly less than half, aren't even shooting for a four-year degree. If you look at people who enroll initially in a four-year school, the number is 65% get a degree. Two-year schools, if you count the number of people who get a certificate, the number of people who get an AA degree, the number of people who transfer to a BA school, that's about 50%. So the number itself has to also be put in context of the student body. So I've done research on this issue, looking closely at what are the factors that determine high and low graduation rates. So, for instance, if you start late, and this is a third of community college students are 24 and over, your chances of successfully getting a degree go down by 75%. I mean, you have a family, you often have kids, you have good intentions, but there's so many other pressures on you, it's very hard to succeed. Similarly, if you start, less than full time, so there are a lot of people, again, in community colleges, don't start full time, and therefore they have much less chance of being successful. And finally, the third more important factor is your grades in high school. More and more people are being encouraged to go into post-secondary education, and certainly we believe that's the right option for many people. But there are things like certificates and two-year degrees, and people who have less than a high B have great difficulty getting a four-year degree. I mean, they've just, for whatever the long-term reasons are, have been unsuccessful at education and turned off by it, and going through the 4 years and all the hoops that you have to do is just going to be a big slog for most of these people. So it's very important when you look at degrees to understand what students are going. If you look at the kind of traditional student, the 18-year-old who graduates with an A from high school and goes directly to school and doesn't work full-time and comes from a good family, well, then you're going to get very high graduation rates. But our world is not like that model that much. We've encouraged more people to go, and as we've encouraged more people to go, we've just basically what statisticians would call added a bad mix. That is, we've added people who have low probabilities of being successful, and we have to understand that because we don't want the notion of pushing a graduation rate up to mean that we aren't going to serve hard-to-serve students. And that becomes a very important issue that's often not discussed in this graduation issue. If we really want to reach out to hard-to-serve students, we're going to have to accept a lower graduation rate.
What about the fact that most traditional schools are not catering at all to the non-traditional older starters, less than full-time students? There's going to be a lot more of those as the population ages, right?
Well, again, I don't know what not caters to means.
Well, they don't have evening classes. You cannot.
Well, certainly at four-year schools, but not at two-year schools.
Okay.
You know, I mean, again, you have this trade-off. And, you know, we would, I mean, we have in our notion ideal worlds. So the older student that comes back and has the job and wants a class at night, even if there were classes at night, the chances of that student getting a four-year degree are just going to be really low. I mean, they're really going to want to narrow the field down into going to a community college, getting an occupationally oriented training courses, that be it in certificate or a two-year degree. But the notion that they're going to go through 4 to 6 to 8 years and stay on board. And the issue also is one of the things that we know. There's a kind of funny phenomenon that makes sense when you think about it, called use it or lose it. That is, the notion of just delay. And when you're in high school, you're using those skills, you're using these kind of academic skills, and when you make the transition, you're continuing to use it. But if you then go away and you're out of high school for 5 years, it's like you're graduating. Let's say you were a B-plus student. If you're graduating from 5 years and then you were to try to go, it would be like you were a C-minus student. That is, there are academic skills that are very specific to academics. And mind you, one might argue that's a problem. But nonetheless, there are academic skills of writing reports and understanding how to understand what the teacher is wanting, to figure out that you're going to answer it and go through. And they deteriorate if you're away from it. And so the notion of that we should try to think that a few tweaks in four-year education that's going to make it more open to older students being successful is probably wishful thinking for most people.
To what extent does any of this have to do with whether or not a student knows what he or she wants to be when they grow up or when they graduate, whatever comes first?
Sure. There's two important issues here. One is major. What you major in matters. And we at the Georgetown Center, you know, at cew.georgetown.edu, have a lot of work on earnings by major. And in my mind, this is a transparency issue. If people want to become philosophers and love it, they should do it. They want to study English literature or foreign languages, they should do it. But they should understand that their economic success after college is likely to be affected by that. So I think what we need here is to try to get more transparency throughout. There should be better counseling for these students, and that's likely to lead to more successes also.
Scott Smallwood, any thoughts about that?
Certainly from our perspective, we would love that increased transparency, and I think Professor Rose is exactly right that there are wide differences by major, but those are very hard to tease out from the data that we generally have access to, and that students generally have access to. So as they're thinking about what their options are, that's information that would be great, but it's not easily available to them.
I think about the students that we've all met in college, back particularly in undergrad, who said, well, I really want to be a teacher, but my dad wants me to go into pre-med, so I'm in pre-med now, and I'm slogging through it. And I think, well, what are their chances for success if they're not doing what they really want to do?
Well, you know, we don't know things like that. I mean, you know, there's obviously a relationship between you'll do better at what you want to do,
uh-huh.
But also, there are limitations of, you know, what are the earnings ranges in most occupations. And teachers historically, non-college teachers, non-post-secondary teachers, but, you know, the high school and elementary school teachers have taken advantage of a highly educated women labor force and have historically been relatively lower paid. And it's just really going to be hard to move up the education ladder there. So there are constraints of just doing what you love. I mean, sometimes I call it the intellectual and caring professions. You know, you think of the poor struggling theater person who you know is waiting tables, waiting for their big breakthrough to be like Dustin Hoffman,
mm-hmm.
whatever. So I mean, there's a lot of complexity out there, and you have to balance it out. And
and the one other thing I would throw into that mix is there's a real difference between what that graduate is going to, what their economic or job prospects might be in year one after their degree and 10 years after their degree. So when presidents of liberal arts colleges come to our office and talk up the liberal arts on a regular basis, they're always going to be focused on the long-term, what they see as the long-term economic benefits and impact and career possibilities for that broad-based education, even if maybe in year one they're not doing as well as somebody with a more pre-professional degree.
100%. Number one, what few people realize is almost half of people who get a BA go on to graduate degree of some sort, and 37% get a graduate degree. So we really should be looking at the long term. Mm. And overall, even if you major in the non-remunerative major, you're still doing well. I mean, our data showed that the typical BA makes $1 million more over the course of a career than a high school graduate. So even if, let's say, you're making 30% less than that, you're still making you're still doing well, and you still have a lot of other skills, and you still have the option to go to graduate school. So there are really a lot of chances. There are a lot of chances to succeed in getting a four-year degree, but there's also a chance. Let's not forget, not everyone is going to get the BA. We believe more people should. About 32% of people have a BA or graduate degree now. Maybe 33% is tending up a little bit. And we think there should be more of that, but there also should be many more people who are getting two-year degrees and certificates. And because the hard-to-serve population who have had bad experiences throughout their high school experiences, it's just a tough slog to expect them to succeed. Some will, and we encourage more to, but it's for a lot of people, the shorter post-secondary education system is very important for them to be successful.
Lauren in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. I was calling because I did drop out of college a few years ago, and I actually just got a promotion at my work. I'm the director of activities in a nursing home. So I am doing what I would have done had I graduated with my degree because it was going to be in gerontology. So I just want to call and say that I've done that, but I did have to go through a lot of trial and error with what I wanted to do, working in restaurants and working my way up into the industry.
Were you scared to drop out? Were you worried?
I was just very confused when I dropped out. I didn't know if that's what I wanted to be doing with my life. And then once I was working in the restaurant industry, I realized working with older people is definitely where I wanted to be, not in customer service.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to add one comment mm-hmm. on that. In the midst of all this, at every kind of educational experiences, there are a range of earnings outcomes. And we kind of just think about what's in the middle. And so the caller, you know, had some college and was then turning around and did find that niche, you know, after being out a couple of years. And that's great. And many people will do that at all this. I mean, we're just talking about what the odds are.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, if you look at the odds, if the odds are if you have a BA, you have a much lower unemployment rate than you have the some college. So these are, you know, it's not saying these are not death knells if you don't get that BA.
Mm-hmm.
Many people succeed without that.
To what extent, Scott Smallwood, do we know, and also Stephen Rose, will online education play a role in the future of higher ed as it pertains to student retention? And any thoughts about that, Scott?
I don't know about student retention, but will it play a role in the future? Absolutely. It's playing a role in the present. It's playing a role in everything that's going to happen in the future. It's transforming how the system works. Will it affect retention? Absolutely. It'll affect everything. But it, one of the things that we think about a lot, and write about and talk to people about, is when it comes to online, certain types of online education can work great, but they often work very well with motivated students.
Mm-hmm.
And once you're dealing with a population that may be less motivated or may have some other challenges, certain types of online education, anyway, may not be the right fit for that population.
Yeah, I would agree entirely with that statement. I mean, I think we're experimenting and going forward. When it's integrated much, you know, I have friends who teach and do a lot online with some non-online stuff, and that could be a good mix going forward. Obviously, higher education is expensive. And we're really, and you know, so I mean, part of the debt issue is because we have to pay it. Somebody's got to pay for this because it's so expensive. And so, in the future, I think there's no question that people are going to turn to this as a way to be more efficient.
Bruce and Galena, you're on the air. We're just about out of time, but I had to squeeze you in.
Oh, I just want to quickly say that I vehemently disagree with those comments about liberal arts education.
Which comments were those? Which one?
You know, that it's going to put you behind the eight ball and you're not going to make as much money and if you've got to sacrifice. I think that, you know, I got a philosophy and religion major from an expensive private university that I had to borrow money and drop out for a year and earn to stay in. But it would come as a great shock to my geology major wife, who went into systems work, and to me, the PNR major, who went into insurance, that it was going to cost us money over time. I mean, I'm not going to say what my income is, but I'm happy.
All right. Well, there's an exception, as Stephen Rose mentioned. There's the exception. Stephen Rose, first of all, Bruce, thanks so much for calling.
You bet.
Stephen Rose of Georgetown University Center on Education and Workforce, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Scott Smallwood, Managing Editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.